of Gaia's Garden, A Guide to Homescale Permaculture. He's now working on a book about agriculture and what's wrong with it and how to fix it. And you're listening to The Recovery Zone here on KBOO Radio, and I'm Stephanie Potter. And to get into the other part of this then, which is also the difference between agriculture and horticulture in terms of power structures. And I think that when we look around, you know, we'll see the news, and Teresa was just talking about how we've dropped 100,000 bombs on the civilians in Iraq and the incredible cruelty of that. Or we look at this greed that goes on with billions of profits for Exxon, or how Enron even happened. And it's horrifying. It's shocking. And yet I think you might be saying that this is just kind of the inevitable outcome of agriculture. It has a strong effect on our social and political life, basically.
It really does. When you look at pre-agricultural or non-agricultural, I think is a better way to call it, societies, the hierarchies are really flat. If there is an actual leader, they usually lead through charisma and kind of personal relationships among the people in the group. Once you start getting to agriculture, I mean, the real hallmark of agriculture is to generate a surplus. That's what agriculture does. And we think of that usually as a good thing. You know, we've got enough stored up to take us through the winter. The real story behind that is that horticultural and foraging people rarely go very hungry. They can almost always find some food. If you know your ecosystem, I mean, even the people living in the Kalahari Desert and really inhospitable places like that can always find some kind of food. Whereas famine up until the age of oil was a really, really regular visitor in agricultural societies. So what happens in agriculture is that you've got to store up a surplus to get you through the hard times, and as soon as you generate a surplus, as soon as you start harvesting more grain than you need right then, someone has to take care of that surplus. Someone has to guard it. Someone has to decide who gets it. And so immediately you start getting into a hierarchical structure, and a strongly hierarchical structure where someone actually has control of a really critical resource of food, and other people don't have access to that food. So immediately you have, you know, you've got a power structure. Then you need people to guard that food supply.
Soldiers.
Right. You need soldiers. Then you've got something that can be a target for other people who maybe don't have food. So now you've got much more in the way of war, or the scale of war becomes much larger once you reach agricultural societies. So you've all of a sudden tipped into this hugely hierarchical system that's just structurally there because of the nature of agriculture. And foraging cultures and horticultural societies don't have anywhere near this kind of hierarchical structure. So we really lost a huge amount of freedom when we moved into agriculture.
And I liked what I read on your website, that these deaths, that you know, we think of the things like the Bill of Rights or the Magna Carta as like, you know, real, you know, signposts of how we're evolving and becoming better people, but you're talking about them as actually just being desperate measures.
Yeah, in foraging and horticultural societies, you have a tremendous amount more freedom. There isn't the kind of leverage on individuals that there is in agricultural society. So, I mean, you don't need a Bill of Rights because nobody is taking your rights away from you. No one has the power to take your rights away from you. And if someone really is behaving in a kind of despotic way, two or three people could just gang up on them and say, okay, stop this.
Right.
You know, they can only rule by being kind of benign rulers instead of just developing power and soldiers and that sort of thing. And this has been really well documented by anthropological studies.
I know. I heard Dale Pindell, he's another author, he had this nice little quote about how you know, we see people kind of clapping around the president when he signed another bill, and he was saying, I think I'd like to just shed another tear, you know, that we need a law to keep us to be good, you know.
Yeah, that's the thing. It's, when you have a power structure like that, it inevitably leads into abuses of power. The more, you know, it is true that power does corrupt.
And another thing that I think you get out of the agricultural society is maybe the sense of slavery. You know, maybe we had animal slaves and then for a long time human slaves, and now we have like what we call wage slaves. So that's, there's, and most of the people are living under that kind of a situation.
Right. It's really based on dominion over. I mean, that is what, you know, any of the deistic systems tell us is that, you know, we have dominion over the other beings on the earth, and thus that sets up the idea of dominion over other individuals. Whereas in foraging and horticultural societies, we have to cooperate with other species because we're dependent on them for everything. We're not telling them what to do. You know, you overhunt your local antelope herd, and you're in trouble right away. So you get very rapid feedback from the environment that you've been making a mistake. Whereas in agriculture, you don't get feedback for the environment for many, many, many years because you're turning it all into food.
And would you say that it almost agriculture encourages maybe sociopaths to rise to the top? I mean, is it that bad?
Well, who is attracted to wielding that kind of power? You know, I think most of the examples in this country are not very well in anywhere. Maybe this country might have some of the better examples, actually, of the kind of people who are attracted to wielding that sort of power.
Yeah, scary. And then another thing that goes on in horticultural societies is more a sense of recycling and gift exchange, that kind of thing, right?
Yeah, although they don't have money, you know, we're told that societies that don't have money must operate by barter. You know, I make an axe and I trade my axe for some of your shoes or that sort of thing. When really barter systems are almost non-existent. It's a myth because we couldn't really think of other ways that people could behave without money. And it turns out that most non-money cultures, and I've seen this in among the native people in Hawaii and many, many other places, it's really a gift economy. It's you bring what you can and other people bring what they can. And if you're a little bit short, well, you know, okay, you gave some at last year's big feast, so we'll tide you over this year. It's a way of really creating a system of almost indebtedness to the community when you don't have enough and the community takes care of you, then you know that you owe. And if someone's a slacker, well, a couple of people will come over and say, hey, come on, kick down. It's your time. But there's very rarely a formal keeping track of, I'm going to trade my axe for your shoes, because it doesn't work that well. What if I don't need shoes, but you need an axe?
Right.
So I give you my axe, and later on, when my shoes wear out, you give me some shoes.
Right. Just it's a more easygoing kind of thing. And yet, here we are in the U.S. of A. right now with a major agricultural thing going on, getting more intense all the time. So I hear a lot of times that we're talking about this idea of change in the U.S. And I think like maybe the epitome of change would be like, say, whoever got in office appointed someone like you as Department of Agriculture, the head of it, and besides maybe changing the name, What is like maybe the first thing that you might want to do?
Well, I don't think we could shift instantly into a horticultural society as much as I would like to see that. But I think looking at simply the scale to start with is, you know, moving from places that are, I mean, a small farm now in the Midwest is 5,000 acres. Now that's considered a small farm. And I think really when we think about small farms, we think of 5 acres or 10 acres or something like that. And I think re-inhabiting those farms again with much smaller scale operations, and I don't even really like to use the word operation, just places where people can actually get to know the piece of ground that they live on and gradually return it into some functioning part of the ecosystem. So that would be one of the first things that, and I think it's going to be inevitable. I think you can only run enormous farms when you have huge amounts of energy to do that, and as oil becomes more expensive and food becomes more expensive, I think a lot more people are going to go back into farming. And then as ideas like permaculture and ecological design become more prevalent, people will begin to recognize that in order to have a sustainable way of living on the planet, we need to be doing a lot less of something like agriculture.
Right. And I think also, like I read Michael Pollan's book about the Omnivore's Dilemma. I mean, it was very interesting to see that this farmer in that book was able to take an old quarry mine that was just basically rock and get the soil back in condition again. I mean, layers of deep topsoil by having the animals, what he called doing the heavy lifting and that kind of thing. So you think this would actually be possible to restore some of the mess that we've made?
I think there are two things that go on. One is that once you stop beating up on an ecosystem, it usually recovers. I mean, it's got to be in really bad shape. It's mostly stopping doing the damage. We've learned this in the restoration of a lot of really badly polluted lakes, where as soon as we stop dumping the sewage into them, the lakes come back very quickly. And then the other thing is that we can make really positive interventions. I mean, we're all taught in school that it takes 1,000 years to make an inch of topsoil and that sort of thing. And in some cases, that's true. But through mulching and growing the right kind of plants, you can actually create soil very, very quickly. It doesn't take long to make really good soil. It's actually one of the easiest things to manipulate in an ecosystem or to restore in an ecosystem. You stop abusing it and you start generating organic matter, and you can build soil really, really quickly. And then you just need to be careful with it and not do things like large-scale plowing. You need to keep things growing on it all the time.
Right. And then another thing, though, is I think an essential aspect of it is to recycle absolutely everything, right? I mean,
nature is unbelievable at recycling. Nature's efficiency at recycling is better than 98%. You know, I mean, you barely find anything that is used in nature that is actually permanently toxic or anything like that. There's no such thing as a garbage dump in nature. There might be things that are recycled more slowly. And so compare that 98% level to even the best of our cities where recycling approaches 30 or 35%. And we have a long way to go. See, I'm not opposed to kind of having and using a lot of things as long as those things are all recyclable. It's when they pile up as garbage and toxics that we're in trouble. I mean, you look at nature, and nature is not, you know, nature is not a place of scarcity. Nature is constantly making more and more and more and more biomass in a wonderful way. So this sense of abundance, I think, is something that we don't have to do without. In the future, that if we take nature as our model, it's incredibly abundant. We just need to be really good at recycling it.
So we still could have our cities, our roads, our internet connections.
I think that things will be on a different scale. I think that, you know, the mega cities like New York and Los Angeles are probably not going to be easy to do with a lot less oil. But I think that I'm sure that we're not going to have an impoverished life devoid of any kind of culture in a horticultural society. See, industrial culture really only permits one culture. And the beautiful thing about foraging and horticultural societies is how diverse they are. There's incredible diversity. I mean, the art that we see in non-industrial cultures is unbelievable and wonderful and very, very skillfully done. So it's not as though, you know, we're just going to go back to staring at blank cave walls or something like that. There's beautiful work done in horticultural societies. So we don't have to do without those things. And that's again, one of the myths that we've been taught, is that these people had no culture, they had no art. And it's, I think, really, when I go to horticultural societies, I feel like the one who has no culture and no art.
Wow, yeah. Well, and another little aspect to this, though, is there are like 6.5 billion of us now. How do you see that kind of playing out in terms of, I mean, it doesn't sound like a horticultural society could feed people or feed this many of us anyway.
Well, any society not based on oil, I mean, I don't care how you do it, but if it's oil that has allowed us to have 6.5 billion people on this planet. And I've got a fair amount of background in population biology, and I have a lot of friends in peak oil. The peak oil movement are, you know, kind of, we're all going to die, is some of the more alarmist point of view. And as a population biologist, I know that when populations in the animal world decrease, it's rarely through a horrible famine. It's usually through a great decrease in the birth rate, and it takes a little while. And I'm hoping, and I think, you know, with nature as our guide, that our population can come down simply because there aren't going to be as many, well, as much energy around. So we're going to have a lot fewer children in the future. And with a slight decline in birth rate, like Europe's birth rate right now, if that were the birth rate for the entire world, we could be down to 2 or 3 billion people in 80 years without any famine or die-off or anything like that.
Right. Whereas in the U.S., I think we're having a baby boomlet or something right now.
Yeah.
But just sort of to wrap up then, maybe you could just let us know what you think the cable listeners, you know, where should they plug into this kind of thing or what can they do?
Well, I teach permaculture, and I've fallen in love with permaculture, an ecological design system based on nature. And that is, to me, one really great avenue. There are a lot of wonderful books out there on permaculture and ecological design. People are offering courses. There are outfits like Trackers Northwest here in Portland, which is involved in kind of re-indigenating places. There's city repair groups that really are trying to teach people how to really reestablish a sense of place, you know, getting to know the place that you're living.
Okay, well, I just want to just thank you. We're going to sign out here. I've been talking to Toby Hemingway with Why Agriculture is Essentially Unsustainable. I want to thank you for being here, Toby. And if people want to find out more, they can also go to your website, right?
Right.
www.patternliteracy.com. Okay? And thanks a lot for coming.
Thank you.
I'm Stephanie Potter. This has been The Recovery Zone on KBOO Radio. And we'll say goodbye now to Toby Hemingway.
Listening to a little Zydeco this morning. This is Ledette, of course, and if you want to know more about that, you can call the air room here at 503-231-8187, and I'll get somebody with better eyeballs than me to look at the very small cursive print on that CD. Coming up next, art-focused host Julie Bernard interviews Prudence Roberts, guest curator of two shows of works by Pacific Northwest artists Carl Morris and Leonard Reuter at the Art Gym at Merrillhurst University. And then at 11, of course, we have Democracy Now! As we do every weekday. And then later on, the Dharma Wheel this afternoon, and of course, the African music that we have each Thursday here on KBOO Portland 90.7 FM. Stay tuned now for Art Focus with host Julia Bernard.
Allons dansons. Écoutez et répétez. Well, I love cubism. It's my favorite style. When I see a cubist painting, I just gotta smile. But there's one painter I'm his biggest fan. He's the father of cubism. His name's Cézanne. Cézanne. Cézanne, Cézanne, the father of cubism. Well, some people say that it was Picasso. Other people claim it was de Chirico. Some people think it was Modigliani. But they're all crazy, it was Paul Cézanne. Cézanne, 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 the father of cubism.
The father of cubism. Good morning, and a beautiful morning it is, much to our surprise and delight. And I have the wonderful Prudence Roberts here with me this morning, and we're
good morning.
Old friends. We both went to the same college, and we both graduated at different times, I much sooner than she. No, I guess you were much sooner than I. I mean, you were... I graduated many, many years ago.
Well, and I took a circuitous route through college, so
did
it took
you?
Me a while to graduate, yeah.
Okay. Well, anyway, here we are both in Portland, and we're not going to sing the Sarah Lawrence fight song today.
No, I don't know it.
I think it passed out of the picture long
sure.
After I left. Okay. Anyway, what we have very interesting things to talk about and Prudence is responsible. Carl Morris is at the Merrill Hurst
Art Gym.
I keep wanting to call it the museum, Merrill Hurst Museum. It is not, but it's full of the very beautiful paintings by Carl Morris. And we're going to talk about those. And we're also going to talk about the work of Leonard Ruder. But we will not have time to talk about that quite as much. But it is there, and he is 90 years old and still alive.
Yep, yep.
And tell us about this exhibition. Why? How did you decide to do this? And what were some of the things that were important that you thought about doing it?
Okay.
It's a wonderful exhibition. Thanks. Everybody should see it.
Thank you. Let's see. Well, I've known Carl Morris's work for years and years, and I think, like a lot of Portlanders, I was more familiar with his later work. You know, the work, the abstract paintings, the large scale abstract paintings that he did, basically starting in the late 1960s and on until his death in 1991. That was kind of the focus of the big retrospective exhibition that was held at the Portland Art Museum some years ago. But during that exhibition, I also was fascinated by his early works, his figurative work, and really interested in how he moved from the figure to abstraction and when he did that.
Mm-hmm.
And I knew a couple of collectors in Portland who have sizable collections of Morris's figurative work. In other words, basically the work he did in the 40s and the 50s. He moved into abstraction kind of beginning in the mid-50s and then, you know, sort of moved back and forth between the figure and abstraction. And last summer, I went to see the incredible show that Larry Fong organized at the Jordan Schnitzer Museum of Art down at the University of Oregon. Mm-hmm. And that show was really, the focus of it was the 9 huge murals that Carl Morris was commissioned to do, for the Hall of Religions at the Oregon Centennial in 1959.
Mm-hmm.
And Morris had, because of red tape and committees and everything, he ended up having like 6 weeks to complete these mural-sized paintings. And he must have worked in this white heat to get them all done. And he also had the challenge of trying to represent something in the line of 170 religions within Oregon. Mm. Now, who came up with the idea of 100? I mean, I don't know what the 170 religions are. But in any event, that sort of freed him from having to deal with, you know, the symbols of Christianity, Judaism, Islam, Buddhism, you know, the major religions, mm-hmm. and gave him kind of this open door to find another way to talk about, visually, to talk about religion. And so he came up with the idea, or formulated the idea, and it's the title or the subtitle of the show, and that is Figure, Word, and Light. Mm-hmm. The idea that that the figure in those paintings, and in many of the paintings in the Hall of Religion paintings, and in many of the paintings in the show, the figure represents the kind of the congregation, the coming together, the brotherhood that religion or spirituality can represent, or sisterhood. Word can represent the word. It, you know, in the beginning was the word. It can represent the text, the sort of the moral code of a religion, and it can represent the dissemination of religion or spirituality. And then light, of course, is where all of these things coalesce, and mm-hmm. you know, that can be representative of a kind of an act of creation or of enlightenment, literally. So those were the ideas that I thought were embodied in his Hall of Religion murals. And all of a sudden, when I saw those, all of his other work, all of his earlier work, sort of took on a different meaning for me. And that mm-hmm. became the way I was thinking about the show. So, a long answer.
This is so well said. I should tell the people that you are at the Portland Community College at Rock Creek.
Mm-hmm.
And are you a professor there?
I teach, yeah, well, we don't have professors at community colleges. I'm an instructor. I'm an art history instructor.
I wanted to get you as high as I could in the lingo.
I don't really care about titles.
I know you don't.
But anyway, yes, I teach art history, and I also run, there's a little gallery out at Rock Creek. And can I make one little plug for the gallery?
Of course.
Because we have a beautiful show right now of collages by Harry Widman, who's better known for his large paintings. He's at Blackfish Gallery, longtime teacher and painter in Portland, and it's just this wonderful little collage show of about 20 of his works that he's done over the years, and I think is less known for. So, but we can go back to Carl Morris now.
Okay. Do you have a special place where you want to start back on Carl Morris, or shall I remind you?
You can feed me a question.
I can feed you a question. I really want to know where the idea of religion comes in, that he was a religious man. This is mentioned a number of times, that he had a personal religion that comes out in his work.
Well, maybe that's a bit, I mean, I think he was more... I don't think he was a fan of any organized religion in any particular way. I mean, I think he saw the problems of organized religion, and but I think he had a sense of the spiritual.
Yes, sense of the spiritual.
Yeah. And good. Also, I think one of the other themes that I wanted to explore in the essay I wrote for the show, probably more than in the show itself, was his relationship to other artists who were dealing with sort of spiritual issues, namely Barnett Newman and Mark Rothko.
Yes.
Morris was a good friend of Rothko's. He had met Rothko when Rothko lived in Portland in his early years and came back to visit his family. And I think that he and Morris met in the early 1940s, so shortly after Morris himself had moved to Portland. And they maintained a friendship up until the time of Rothko's death in 1971, I think. So they knew each other over a long period of time. And I think, and certainly Morris had a gallery in New York. He went back to New York quite regularly. He was in a lot of the Whitney biennials in those days. And certainly he must have, well, I know that he talked to Rothko about things like painting and maybe not directly spirituality. But one of the theses of the show is that this move from figurative to abstract work, and Rothko moved in that direction in the late 1940s, early 1950s, and so too did Carl Morris, and so did Barnett Newman. All of that, I think, has a lot to do with the aftermath of World War II. The reality of the Holocaust, the reality of the atomic bomb. How do you live in a world, how do you make art that matters in a world that has witnessed those two sort of completely altering experience, events?
Yes.
How do you make art that matters? And maybe the figure and the still life and, the narrative painting no longer matter in that way. And maybe you try to make art that is important in this other way. And I don't think I expressed that quite well.
You did, but, very okay. Well. Let's talk about his method of painting at this time, which was different later.
Mm-hmm.
That it has a crude kind of a treatment of the paint in a way that the paint is put on and then scraped off.
Yeah,
I don't know
kind
whether
of,
crude. It's
not
a
crude,
rock,
earthy,
like the outside of rocks.
Right, it's earthy.
Yeah,
it's earthy. It's this kind of materiel of the paint. Yeah, exactly. And he's doing a lot of sort of what's called sgraffito, scraping back in to create those little calligraphic figures, things like that. Yeah, and there's this kind of raspy quality to the paint.
And he's very effective.
Yeah,
it's as if he wants to make it look like the center of the earth.
Yeah, and the figure and the ground, or the figure and the rock, are one. I mean, you notice those kind of faceted figures that in the works from the 1940s, say, that are really sort of part of the landscape that they inhabit.
It's like he mined it and found some color.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, and his color is brilliant. His color is
particularly
glorious.
Particularly a glorious red.
Yeah, yeah, and blues.
Glorious is a good word for it.
Yeah.
And they come sailing out but the painting will give an impression of being so dark,
mm-hmm.
but it's a prize mm-hmm. to find a deep, pure color
mm-hmm.
that's been put in the heart of it.
And an inner illumination.
Yeah,
I think there's very much that.
Yeah.
And, you know, Morris was born in California. He scraped together enough money to go to the Art Institute of Chicago, where he studied, and then he went to Europe right before for the Second World War and studied in Vienna for a couple of years and then traveled around, of course, and came back, you know, because of the outbreak of the war. So when he came to the West, he really came out to Spokane as to head a federal arts project in Spokane and then eventually in 1941 pretty much settled in Portland. So that's kind of how he got here. And so he is and isn't a West Coast artist. You know, he is mm-hmm. a West Coast artist because he chose to live here. He chose not to move back to New York. He was often linked with the sort of the Northwest Mystics school, you know, Graves, Callahan, Kenneth Callahan,
yes.
Morris Graves, and Mark Tobey. And he really wasn't part of that school. He wasn't comfortable being part of any particular group. He wasn't part of a group in Portland. He wasn't part of a New York group, and he certainly wasn't part of the New York, the Northwest Mystics. Although he was a very good friend, Mark Tobey was a lifelong friend, and I think had some influence. I mean, they influenced each other back and forth. Morris also loved music, jazz in his younger years, and classical music. He had a lot of friends in the world of music and also in poetry. So he was, all of those influences inform his painting.
Was his wife very helpful to him
yes.
in his efforts?
And vice versa.
Yes. And she was a great artist herself.
Oh, she was a terrific artist.
Did
and
they
I hope...
get along well?
I have no idea.
I wonder if they didn't scrap over.
No, I don't know.
What was good and what was bad.
I don't know. I think they had passionate conversations, let's put it that way.
I
know
that
she helped him when, for instance, there's a great photograph of him working on the Hall of Religions murals where she is in there helping him. I mean, how could he have completed those things in 6 weeks without her help? But I hope everyone saw the Hilda Morris show that was at the museum last summer.
I certainly hope so.
It was beautiful.
It was
just fantastic.
Just a fabulous show.
Bruce Gunther did an amazing job on that exhibition.
We had somebody came on KABU, and I can't remember who it was, and we had a couple of times when we talked about that show, two separate times.
Mm-hmm.
And people were very impressed with that show because it's just hit the heart of an Oregonian.
Yes.
It was so full of the sea. The sea.
And the forests.
And so
it was
Oregon.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Just probably better done than anybody else.
Yeah,
ever.
I agree.
Yeah. And but anyway, there's nothing of her in the show that I can think of.
No,
don't. It's all Carl, and I think that the people get the impression that it's full of kind of stories about religion, and I think it's not religion.
No. And I certainly don't mean to imply that.
No.
The big story is really how he moved from figuration to abstraction.
Yeah.
And the very early works in the show are kind of WPA style, you know, that kind of social realism, which of course was what he was doing like everyone else if he was working for the WPA. And he had, you know, the big mural commission for the post office in Eugene, which was one of the reasons that he came back here.
Uh-huh.
So he's working in that WPA style. And then you start seeing how that 1942-43, how he starts pulling away in other directions that show an interest in, you know, other aspects of modernism, and certainly show his European training. And then by the end of the show, by the 60s, he's doing, you know, paintings that are pretty much abstract, although still have these references to word, to tablet. And he worked in series a lot. So he played out, you know, worried out his ideas over several canvases, not just one, usually. The other thing that I might mention about the show is the little tiny jewel room.
Yes.
I don't know what we call that room, but it's, to me, it's like the little, cabinet of wonders.
Remember, but then I never can remember anything. So.
but that show, that little room has some drawings and studies in it. And it's just, there's some beautiful little, well, you know, Carl and Hilda both did Sumi ink drawings.
Yes.
Drawings on Japanese paper. And there are a couple of those figure studies in there that are just glorious and show what a consummate draftsman Morris was. And then some very little, like 4 by 6 inch studies for the Hall of Religions murals. So definitely, if you go to the show, be sure to go into that little tiny closet room.
Yes.
Because there's some just little gems
there
in there.
Always are.
Yeah,
they
I know.
Always tuck
know.
Things away in there. And it's very often holds the best art in the whole place.
The little surprises.
Little surprises.
Yeah.
Yeah. We must say something about the other little room, the small room, which I can't remember the name of that one either. I'm not very knowledgeable this
Gallery
morning.
B or something, I think it's called. I never can remember either. But
And Leonard Ruder is in there.
Yes.
In very interesting paintings.
Yes, and I'm not really the person to speak about those. That's really Silas Cook who organized
Silas.
That you should. Yeah.
And tell who Silas is.
Silas Cook is the, I think his title is the assistant director of the Cooley Gallery at Reed College. And he also is in charge of the wonderful designs for their exhibitions. And Silas has been there for about 15?
Many years.
Long time. And
20, 30 years?
I don't think 30. I think more like 15 to 20.
15 to 20. Yeah, okay.
And the Leonard Ruder show, Terry Hopkins, and let me just say what an amazing woman Terry Hopkins is. I had approached her a few years ago, about 3 years ago, probably about maybe someday doing a Carl Morris show, because now the Art Gym is kind of reaching backward in time and doing some more historic shows. And she came up with the idea of pairing Leonard Ruder and Carl Morris, who are roughly contemporary in age. Leonard Ruder is maybe a little bit younger than Carl
Morris. He's 90 years old.
Right. And Carl died in 91 when he was about 80-something. So, but her thought was that they were roughly contemporaries, that they had both, you know, devoted their lives to painting, but Ruder painted, painting was not his day job. He had gone to art school. Mm-hmm. He showed in Oregon biennials and so forth, and then he pretty much withdrew from the art world and simply painted.
He had an elegant education.
He had an elegant education, yes. And he showed at the Rental Sales Gallery for a number of years at the Portland Art Museum.
Yeah.
But where Carl's career was a very public one, Ruder's was a very private one. And yet they both were sort of responding to the same influences, both looking at abstraction at about the same time. So there are these fascinating correlations or parallels between their lives.
This is an interesting comparison.
Yeah, it's a fascinating comparison.
A Ruder is kind of, he's slick in comparison.
Well,
can
I
you
think
say
was,
that? No, you can't.
I don't know. That sounds a little pejorative, and I don't think you mean it to be.
No, I don't.
I think that Ruder, and this is not knowing very much about
He's very smooth and modern.
Well, he's responding to, I think, to what was going on in the School of American Abstract Art in the 40s and the 50s.
Yeah.
In a way that Morris
into
wasn't.
Outer space.
Yeah, kind of. Yeah.
Some of them.
Yeah.
Machinery.
Machinery, he was fascinated with machinery. Yes.
Fabulous, colorful machinery.
Yeah.
And I got the feeling that he was painting what he heard as well as what he saw sometimes.
Well, I think that's a good, yeah, I think that's a good idea.
And it was machinery that is beautiful and shiny mm-hmm. and new.
Mm-hmm.
And they're very clean cut.
Mm-hmm.
And quite exciting in his use of space.
Yeah, yeah. No, they're fascinating paintings, and I think the I think it's really fun to have those two artists.
It's amazing.
Who, yeah, it is. It is, and they probably showed together in the same Portland biennials and things like that, or Portland annuals, I guess it was in those days. But anyway, yeah. So here they were working. In these entirely different sort of sets of circumstances.
Now, who has Reuter? Does he? Who's in his family? That does he have some promoters? Kind of.
Well,
that he's
I think
in this
that.
Show?
I think that his work was brought to the attention of Silas by one of his children,
and
Silas went to look at this. At the, thinking, oh, what am I getting myself into, sort of, and went to see this whole archive of work and was really, really impressed.
It bowled him
really,
over.
Really, yeah, it bowled him over.
Yes.
So,
I think we might try to get Mr. Reuter on the air.
You should get Silas.
We'll get Silas.
Yeah, I'd get Silas on the air.
Oh, yeah. All right. Well, we're going to do that.
You should definitely do that.
Definitely. Yeah. Okay. He has interesting names. Mr. Reuter has some interesting names on his work. He has Lizards of Nod.
Yeah, I can't comment on that. That's really Silas's.
I can't
either. Yeah.
And, okay, well, we'll save that for
Silas. Yeah, save that for Silas.
He has this humorous kind of attachment of names.
Yeah.
So we'll save that. Okay, I'm going to turn back here. In 1960, there's a Sumi experiment. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Well, both, that Hilda Morris is really well known for her Sumi. I mean, her Sumi paintings.
Mm-hmm.
And Carl, I think, if I remember correctly, they both started exploring Sumi things, or Sumi the medium, when they were living in Seattle. And that was probably in the late 30s after the Spokane. Carl and Hilda met in Spokane. He basically hired her to come out as an art teacher.
I see.
And they got married in the late 30s and lived in Seattle for a while, where they got to know Mark Toby really well. And I think it was through the influence of Toby and that they started finding these beautiful Japanese papers and working with Sumi ink. So it was something that Carl returned to over and over again. The works that are in the show are from the 60s, but it's not to say that he didn't do later and earlier Sumi pieces. So, yeah. So
I see. Okay. I had an interesting experience with Carl Morris.
Oh, you did? I only met him once.
We went to dinner at a home where the gentleman of that home mm-hmm. had done some work for Carl Morris,
mm-hmm.
and in return Carl Morris had become his friend mm-hmm. and gave him a couple of paintings, and we were invited to that party,
mm-hmm.
and it was just us and the Morrises and them.
Mm-hmm.
And they had a gorgeous view of the city. And there was the big pink sitting up there. Mm-hmm. That building is, the bank building, isn't it? The U.S. Bank building.
Mm-hmm.
And the sun was going down, and it was turning pink, just as it should. And we all sent around a question, do you like big pink? And Carl Morris did not like Big Pink World. and it was kind of an interesting, funny moment.
Yeah.
And Mrs. Carl Morris,
Hilda,
was not sure, but she had quite a lot to say about it. And it was very interesting what she had to say.
Mm-hmm.
And he kept interspersing that he didn't like it.
Oh, God.
And anyway, the sun went down and everything, and the big pink disappeared from my sight. And I have always remembered that conversation between those two great artists and their arguments and the discussion that they had. It was a wonderful discussion, and I wish that we'd had some way to have taken that down, and I would have played it here this morning for you.
Well, Morris was, as we were talking earlier, I think Morris, you know, he worked really hard. He worked really hard. So did Hilda. And he maintained, I mean, he lived in Portland. I mean, he sort of called Portland or Oregon his studio in a way. And felt that moving to New York would have been sort of leaving his studio. He didn't want to be in the marketplace of art. He wanted that kind of freedom, and he talked about the fact in some of his interviews that his friends like Rothko and Clifford Still and Robert Motherwell, people like that, were so kind of locked into the commercial world of art that they had lost that kind of freedom, that they, you know, it would be like somebody walking into your studio every day and interrupting what you were doing. Morris felt to have lived in New York and been that close to the marketplace.
Yes.
So he really valued, he really treasured living in Oregon, far away from that.
That's good.
So, yeah, yeah.
Well, was he internationally known?
I don't think so. I think at some point he chose to step away and stay in his studio rather than to pursue that kind of,
does
that
he still have a gallery in New York?
No.
There's no gallery that any...
He showed it at a gallery called Krauschauer Gallery for a number of years, and he was he got there as one of 10 Oregon artists. There was this show to sort of introduce 10 artists from Oregon, including Louis Bunce, Mike Russo, some of the other artists of Carl's generation. And Carl was the one who sort of pursued it, and he had Krauschauer for a number of years. Krauschauer is no longer operating a gallery space. I understand they do things by appointment, so it may well be that they're still selling things. But Laura Russo here in Portland, of course, has the Carl Morris Estate.
I see.
Yeah, the Laura Russo Gallery.
Okay.
Yeah.
These two very, very wonderful catalogs. I want to talk about the catalogs just for a minute. Do you want to do that? They're very, very fine, and okay, I've been being told I can't talk about them at all because I'm out of time and I'm still blabbering on and on. Anyway, I'm so glad you came this morning. We've been talking to Prudence Roberts, and Prudence Roberts has been on the air with Auntie Julia a number of times. And
always a pleasure.
We could go on for another half an hour or more, probably. And thank you so much for coming this morning.
Thank you for inviting me, Julia. Please get to see the show if you get a chance.
I have seen the
show. Oh, no, not you. The listeners.
Oh, world.
Those listeners.
Yes,
right.
World. Be sure to see this show. It's a very important show and a very good one, and you'll be very happy that you have that in your brains to think about for a little while. Thanks again. And this is Julie Bernard and Art Focus.
And this is KBO Portland. This KBU program has been made possible in part by KBU Foundation members and a grant from Ironwood Holistic Care Home, providing continuing care for you or your loved one, located in Northwest Portland and specializing in senior memory and hospice care. For information, the number is 503-644-4038 or by email to ironwoodholistic, one word, @gmail.com. And now stay tuned for Democracy Now!
From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
CIA has not used water.